The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Here's how Native history reads for many Americans. Indians welcome pilgrims at Thanksgiving. Tribes sent west on the Trail of Tears. Lots of fight with cowboys, reservations, casinos. And now they're fighting the American government again over an oil and gas pipeline out west. That leaves a lot of holes that get filled in with stereotypes, prejudice, and myths that have misinformed generations. Europeans brought culture to the backwoods and savage Indians. Indians are predisposed to alcoholism. Most are on welfare. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker have written a new book to dispel all these myths. It's called All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. Virginia spoke to them earlier this week.
So just that title, All the Real Indians Died Off, what is a real Indian?
A real Indian, the reason that we have that title in there is to emphasize the concept of real. It goes back to the core myth. The core myth in this country is the myth of the vanishing native. And from that myth, we can trace almost, if not all, the myths that we name in this book. And so when you talk about native people vanishing, which is a settler fantasy, we then talk about the concept of authenticity. So native people, if native people are all gone, but yet we know that there are at least 3 million to 5 million Native Americans, you know, that identify themselves on the U.S. Census, and 567 federally recognized tribes in the United States, there's a paradox there. And so the way that that plays out is that, okay, there might be Native Americans still left, but they're not real Indians because they don't meet the stereotypical understandings of what an Indian is. And all those stereotypes are, you know, based on they don't look the way Indians in the 19th century look. They don't dress that way. Because they live in a frozen, unchanging past, they can't be modern. Therefore, they are inauthentic.
It is amazing how well-formed a lot of people's picture might be if you say Indian. And it does harken back to these 19th century images. But how about that term itself? Indian, Native American, you said tribe, some say nations, First Nation, Indigenous. Is there a right thing to call you and people of Native American descent?
This is one of our myths. They don't even know what to call themselves. It's one of the myths. Just because they're all of the words are colonial words, Indian is not, you know, none of them are equal to the N word except for redskins. That is equal to the N word because it, you know, what it harkens back to is genocide and heads being cut off by pilgrims and early settlers for bounty and the bloody corpse that's left. But other than that, Indian, Native American, indigenous peoples, which we use more and more, these are terms like Africa and Europe and Asia. Those things mean nothing about the specific cultures. And we use them as generalities, but of course, Native people prefer to be called by their nationality, by their national name, you know, Cherokee or Lakota, Dakota, Oglala for the Sioux.
Well, I notice you don't actually even use the full word redskins in your book. You use an asterisk in the book. And you mentioned that this is a name that the colonists actually called Native Americans. One of the feel-good narratives that surfaces at this time of year leads to one of your myths, that Thanksgiving proves that the Indians welcomed the pilgrims. Did they?
Not really. Not exactly. Not in the way that the myth has been perpetuated. You know, we talk about in the book, we go into the actual history based on the primary source documents about what actually happened. What happens is the Plymouth colony, the Mayflower people come, they set up in the middle of winter, they are starving, they encounter the Wampanoag people, and the Wampanoag people are surviving this dramatic depopulation due to an epidemic in the last couple of years. And so both people are in a state of desperation. The Wampanoag are compromised militarily in their battles or their conflicts with the Narragansett. So what they are faced with is a situation of mutual desperation, and so they form a treaty with each other. So this friendship is really based on a need for mutual political self-assurance, and that's really the story that gets woven into this feel-good narrative about, you know, Indians welcoming pilgrims. I mean, within the next, 50 years, it degrades into a full-scale war. So this period of peace doesn't last very long.
And you know what's important about the myth is that Thanksgiving, when it was invented by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, had no pilgrims and no Indians. It was only about families coming together during war, being together, being thankful, and mourning their losses. So it was not created, the myth wasn't created until the Depression. And school teachers picked up on it and innovated all the, you know, the hats and the costumes and everything. So it's a completely made-up myth very recently, only in the 30s, when they're trying to create a new American nationalism. So, you know, Thanksgiving should go back to its origins and not be about pilgrims and Indians, but be about Thanksgiving, just families being together and eating together.
Well, how did these kind of myths and the myths of, you know, the savage Indian or the other narrative of the noble savage Indian support United States policy against the Indians and all that bloodshed that followed that first Thanksgiving?
Well, it was needed because the Europeans needed a justification for coming and taking of the land. I mean, you know, most of us by now know what the concept of manifest destiny is, you know, this divine right that the Europeans believed that they had, you know, granted from God to inherit the land. And so the way that they did this was they created these narratives about indigenous native inferiority. And that goes back to before they even came here. It goes back to the days of Spanish law and the formation of international law. It morphs into this doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery is the very embodiment of this concept of Indian inferiority, which grants the right of the superior conquering race to come in and take over.
We're talking with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker. They're authors of a new book, All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. Well, as we said, there are big leaps, big gaps in the kind of history that most Americans learn about Native Americans. But right now, what we are hearing about a lot is the protests against the completion of the Dakota Access Pipeline. A number of tribes, I think more than 250 nations, have joined together in support of the Lakota Sioux and protecting their sacred land. And now this is something, a protest that has spread all over the country. Why now? Why do you think there is this emergence of political activity? Or do you think we're just hearing about it?
Well, I think what's galvanized this new or seemingly new movement is, number one, the messaging. The messaging is all about water. Because the water system of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation is perceived to be compromised, and it is, by the building of this pipeline underneath their lake, it brings up the worldview of the Lakota people. Maniwichone, water is life. And it just so happens that it's the same water supply for 17 million people downstream. So it's not an isolated issue. it involves all kinds of other people. So it's, you know, these multiple stakeholders that are involved. And I think there's also something that, you know, with the tribes, other tribes getting involved, to me it seems to be a message of a collective enough is enough, of having treaties be trampled on, their rights continually violated, because it's not happening just at Standing Rock. It happens with every tribal nation in this country. They are all fighting various different battles. And so this is just one of those moments in time that brings it all together.
But it's also true what you said, that it's being noticed this time, because there are struggles going on constantly all over the Americas. It's hard to keep up with them, you know, if you're on a news feed that gives them to you, but people don't hear about it unless they get on those feeds and are informed directly. And when Red Warrior Camp was set up in April, it didn't get any attention at all outside of, you know, Native media until August. So it was kind of a surprise, and I think, you know, Dina's correct that it had to do with water and also the recent Flint crisis, that people felt a sense of identity to it that didn't make it, to them an esoteric Native issue. But there is an esoteric Native issue that people should learn, and that is about the treaties and the treaty rights Native people have, that this pipeline shouldn't have been built or approved of at all.
And this is something we learn more about in your book, you know, the number of myths that U.S. presidents were benevolent or at least fair-minded towards Indians in the past, that the U.S. did not have a policy of genocide. I mean, these are really, I think for a lot of people, will be kind of shocking ways to think about the history of the United States. But also I want to just talk for a little bit about the protesters. And you do in your book also talk about this kind of idea that Native culture belongs to all Americans. This is something that was especially embraced by New Age culture, this neo-paganist, or this idea that, you know, the Great Spirit belongs to all of us. In one way, that is unifying. In another way, not. So how would you look at it?
Well, we talk about the concept of how, in the context of New Age appropriation of Native American spirituality and ceremonies, how the First Amendment gets deployed to justify it. It becomes a free speech issue, and that's been argued a lot in the New Age literature. And what that does, it's a universalizing narrative. But the point that we make is that this universalizing is, it completely sidesteps and evades the fact that for example, in this case, in Native spirituality, the cultures and the religions, the spiritual practices of Native people were built on very specific histories. They come out of very specific languages and very specific ways of living. And so when you factor all of that in, there are particularities that don't translate. You cannot say that Lakota sacred ceremony means the same thing to everyone, and that because of that, everybody should have a right to it.
But do you think on some level that narrative and the appropriation that comes with it may have a lot to do with why people are learning more about Native American culture than they probably learned in school, or, you know, reading Black Elk Speaks when they were in college?
You know, it's a double-edged sword. They're not really learning about Native Americans. They're learning about a certain image. You know, it's sort of the way they appropriated Hindu practices, gurus, or Zen Buddhism. You know, they take it out of the cultural context and make it an individualistic thing, whereas it's a collective. You know, it's a for Native people, it's a community, a collective that brings people together around principles of living, and not just ceremonies as performance. But the other thing is that this appropriation also evades politics, evades that Native people can be political people. For example, the environmental movement that has been active for almost 50 years now has been blindingly white and upper middle class. And now with this, with the Standing Rock, with this pipeline issue, Native people took the handle. They took hold of the leadership. And this is really the most positive thing at all.
Well, Roxanne, Dina, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Virginia Prescott there, speaking with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker, authors of the book All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. The holidays are on the horizon, and that means all across the country, people will be awkwardly avoiding or actively engaging in discussion about the recent election. Gatherings of family and friends can be great, but when personalities collide, it can be hard to know how to handle those hidden tensions that might just be simmering just below the surface. In a few minutes, we're going to speak with a therapist and author about how to cope with passive aggression. Passive aggressiveness. What do you say? Passive aggression.
I'd say passive aggression, but...
Yeah. We're going to talk to a therapist and author about how to cope with passive aggression in your life. But first, we wanted to get the gang together here at Word of Mouth to talk it out in the studio and steel ourselves for the upcoming holiday gatherings. So joining me in the studio is Logan Shannon. Hi, Logan.
Hello.
Maureen McMurray. Hi, Maureen.
Hi.
And Jimmy Gutierrez. Hey, Jimmy.
What?
So just curious, who here feels like they're the most passive aggressive one in the group or in their family dynamic?
Hmm.
No?
I try to just be, like, direct and aggressive. I try to be aggressive-aggressive, not passive-aggressive.
Yeah. We're all pretty outspoken.
I'm aggressive-aggressive, too. So
I think I'm avoidance-aggressive. So when push comes to shove, I will be direct, but I avoid as much as possible.
Right. You know, with holidays coming up after an election, there's going to be... You know, families who are going to sort of either collectively and unspokenly agree not to talk about it at all. Families who like dive in and that's what they want to do. And then there's those split families. That's the tough thing, I think, is when you have a family that has some people that would rather not talk about it and some people that, you know, really, really want to. Right?
I think my family is a split family in the sense that my father and my brother are incredible debaters, but in such a way that like the rest of us don't feel we're up to the challenge. Like we don't have our receipts. Like we don't have a way to sort of back up our statements. And we sort of dissolve into tears because it's so intense. So in our family, I think we usually try to agree, like we're not going to do it. And then it happens anyway.
Yeah. 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 Jimmy, do you instigate? Do you go in there with the, you know, the idea of maybe pushing a little buttons?
Well, I'm going to leave one family out of it because that would... That would just be a smart move, but so I have a family of drinkers, not debaters. So there is nothing that we talk about, essentially, that's, you know, hot button. This is completely void of politics. So that's just the aggression approach works best with people that may be a little inebriated. I don't know. Like, as far as the politics go, I think, yeah, I haven't mastered how to have those conversations.
Yeah. I was sort of thinking that there's a big difference between, like, family gatherings and work environments where... You know, in family, I mean, there's so much history often that sometimes, like, you know that these things are going to happen and you feel like you can't change them. Whereas at your job, like, there's maybe more incentive and an expectation that, like, you deal with confrontation. Like, you have a job to do.
Well, and in a family situation, personally, in my family situation, it's like this weird change comes over me, like the opposite of the Hulk, where I walk in, I'm the youngest of four, and I'm a grown woman. And I walk into that environment, and suddenly I am 11, and I am furious, and I want to, like, stamp my fists, and I, like, run out of the room, and it's crazy. I have no control over it. I feel like my entire personality of as an adult shrinks away, I become the kid that everyone picked on in our family, and I can't stand up for myself. I remember at one family gathering producing my driver's license and like showing it to all of them and being like, I am 23 years old and you need to listen to me. Like, it was ridiculous. I was so embarrassed. Like, I couldn't, but I had no control over it.
Yeah. Maureen, you're nodding.
I'm nodding furiously because I am also the youngest of four children and I feel the exact same way as Logan. It's just like you fall into this role, but as you're getting older, your siblings are getting older. So you're always seen as the youngest. And my mom is Democrat, my dad's Republican. So that leads to some just straight up aggressive. But when it comes to personal matters, that's where it's more passive aggressive. And I find being the youngest, specifically for me, I had a child last year, so I have one kid. And I can't even begin to tell you how many times, even during maternity leave, you know, you're tired and just overwhelmed. And my mom would be like, oh, you know, four kids. How did we do it? How did I do it?
Oh.
Does that? And I was like, and that my siblings also who have, my sister has three children, my brother has two children, they kind of look at me and are like, oh, remember those days? Oh, when you thought it was so hard. And yeah, so I get that type of like passive aggressive to the point that I had to step up and be like, Mom, you're not helping. I'm like super mad. This is super annoying. But and I guarantee, because I'm going to my sister's for Thanksgiving, I will get that. How did we do it?
Do you think that the best, because I'm really curious to ask our guest in a few minutes, but do you think it's sort of better to have people who aren't passive aggressive try and work with a passive aggressive individual, or is it more the onus of a passive aggressive individual to maybe try and learn to speak up and sort of confront those hidden angers, you know, because it seems like the onus is on someone to change.
I think it's, unfortunately, I think the onus is on the non-passive aggressive person. So the more direct person has to call a passive aggressive person out when they're doing that, so they learn to recognize that behavior and change it.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Taylor.
Thanks, Taylor.
Oh, gosh, should we talk about work? Let's not even do it.
Let's stick to family.
Molly, no. Molly's in the next room, symboling wildly that we should not do that. Joining us now is Lorianne Oberlin. She's a licensed therapist in Maryland, also co-author with Tim Murphy of Overcoming Passive Aggression, How to Stop Hidden Anger from Spoiling Your Relationships, Career, and Happiness. And Lorianne, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So I had to have a laugh because your book came in the mail, and when I opened it up, we were all joking that what more passive-aggressive act could you have than to casually leave your book on someone's desk or maybe wrap it up and give it to him as a present or something like that.
That's true. We hope that the book is actually for those people who are dealing with people in their lives who are passive-aggressive. And of course, the person who might have some awareness that they avoid conflict and are very indirect and maybe procrastinate and come up with a million excuses, maybe they'll have a little bit of awareness and, you know, who knows, maybe they'll gravitate to the book too.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that I think most people, even those who wouldn't classify themselves as having passive-aggressive tendencies, have their moments where they have a passive-aggressive behavior, and you don't always realize it when you're doing it, do you?
No, you don't. You know, sometimes you are very deliberate because you are just ticked off and you want to get back at somebody. There are other cases where you may have, let's say, a visceral reaction, but also you have all that family history and conditioning that tells you not to speak up, that tells you that your emotion might not be allowed. And, you know, in some families, anger is just taboo. And, you know, my co-author and I say that it's sometimes okay to be angry. It's never okay to be mean. And when passive aggression, you know, lapses into that meanness, and especially key to our definition of hidden anger, over time, then you know that you're looking at a deeper problem.
Yeah. And what you just said really speaks to something Logan mentioned, which was that roles often switch when you get home.
Yes, that's true. You know, we all have roles in our family, and our family of origin is the single most important influencer of who and what we are to become, but even more important, sort of the how. How do we solve conflict or avoid it? And some people just replicate that down the genogram, you know, generation to generation, and others take some awareness that they have gained along the way. Maybe somebody kind enough to point out something, hopefully in a tactful, not passive-aggressive way, has been helpful to you. And, you know, maybe through your own study, education, experiences in the work life, in relationships, and if not, maybe even in counseling.
Now, what do you think is easier, learning to cope with passive-aggressiveness in others and come up with strategies for maybe dealing with that, or is it, as passive-aggressive individuals, learning to express your own anger in a healthier way? Where do you think the change is likely to come from, if it's going to come at all?
Well, I think the change has to come from within yourself. So, you know, that's a two-pronged question there, Taylor. And, you know, if you are the one who is angry, then definitely trying to have a different perception of anger. And, you know, anger can really be useful sometimes. If we weren't angry and upset over circumstances, we wouldn't make change in the world. But, you know, again, it should never be mean. It should not diminish other people. So, you know, when people are under stress, they do one of three things. They will explode, they'll implode. That's where the negativity and the self-blame, and you give people the silent treatment, you put off problem-solving or doing something. And then that third choice, which is so much healthier, is to just calmly take a stand. And we hope that we do teach people to be a little bit more assertive in the book, you know, taking an even tone, a deep breath, learning to set some boundaries and proper limits with people so that you don't end up the proverbial people pleaser. Using I messages, because as soon as you start phrasing things with you this or why questions, the other person spends more time thinking how they're going to defend themselves and what their argument is going to be than really spending time listening to whatever it is that you want to say.
Yeah, that sounds like a big message that we could take away too right now, where you know, a lot of people in the country are feeling unhappy or maybe excited about the direction of the nation. And it's hard sometimes to, I guess, phrase those things, like you said, from the I standpoint. But then again, there's this part of me that thinks, you know, for families that really are divided either on politics or whatever it could be, you know, maybe if the holidays are something that come and go and you don't spend too much time with your family otherwise, maybe the best thing to do is to avoid the confrontation. Is that ever a good strategy?
Well, you know, it depends the gradation, I suppose, of ignore. You know, cut off, that means, you know, just not speaking with someone else should really be used with caution. Now, granted, there are situations where a relationship is toxic and maybe, you know, you're there. But in many cases, people think that by cutting off emotionally or even distance-wise from another person is going to solve all of their problems. And what we find in this field is that it truly doesn't. It creates a lot of anxiety. It's still there, and it usually creeps back into other relationships. Because if you have had disappointing employment prospects, or you have had difficult relationships, the best thing that you can do is kind of learn what your role and your part of that was and what maybe you could change. But, you know, the healthy part of ignoring, to get back to your question, is that, you know, in a civilized world, not every single thing has to be confronted. There are many little things that happen that we could just ignore. And we could talk friendly. And if necessary, we could be firm with a person. That's the assertiveness step. And if all else fails, then yeah, we might need to get help. That's a mnemonic that I have learned to use in my practice.
Wait, did that spell a word?
It does. It's a mnemonic. It's debug. So it's do ignore, exit, or move away, be friendly, use firm language, and get help.
I love a good mnemonic.
Yeah, and it you know, sometimes just having that in the back of your mind is helpful.
So what would you say then for general tips, knowing that obviously our listeners are composed of people of all sorts of different personality types, general tips for just assessing the situation if they think they're going into a tense holiday gathering, how best to go into it?
Well, you know, I think it comes down to knowing yourself and your values, how you want to spend your holiday. Again, if you are conditioned to spend your holiday the way someone else dictates, then it could be a recipe for unhappiness. You know, people who are passive-aggressive around the holidays are great at guilting. They are great at keeping score. You know, you spent this amount of time with her parents. How come you're not spending it with me? Or, oh, you folks go right ahead. You know, I have some TV dinners. You know, I mean, that's the kind of guilt that is subtle when people don't want to come out and say, hey, I'd really like to spend the holiday with you. You know, so I think that if you know you're going into some situations, you identify what kind of gathering you really would like. You try to create that for yourself. It may mean setting some limits so that you put in an appearance, but maybe you don't spend the entire day. You know, another thing is just attending to your own reactions. So if somebody says something that is you know, bothersome to you, again, use that debug mnemonic, but think about it. You know, do you have to react in a harsh way? Attend to your hurt feelings and maybe attend to other people's hurt feelings. You know, with this divisive year that we have had in politics, I do think that a lot of discussions are going to come up, but be willing to maybe state your position but not make a huge deal out of it.
Lorianne Oberlin, therapist and co-author with Tim Murphy of the new book, Overcoming Passive Aggression, How to Stop Hidden Anger from Spoiling Your Relationships, Career, and Happiness. You can find out more at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, a time to gather with family, give gratitude, and if you've got it, eat lots of turkey. But before you carve up that bird, you might want to stop for a moment and honor its sacrifice. Scott Carrier brings us this story.
In the mountains of central Utah, there's a small town called Moroni. Moroni is the home base of the Moroni Feed Company, a modern farming cooperative of 140 growers and about 2.5 million turkeys. In the summer, in dry weather, the turkeys kick up dust that hangs over Moroni like a smog cloud. They're busy then, eating and gaining weight. Turkeys are good at that. They can grow from the egg to 45 pounds in just 27 weeks. Now, in the fall, the ground is cold and wet, and the turkeys stand around huddled into huge white clouds, 20,000 here, 30,000 across the road. Each turkey looks the same, like a small white ostrich with a bright red wattle and sky blue stain around its eyes. Every eye holds the same bewildered look, the kind of look that says, "What was I saying? What was I saying?"
It's said that a small turkey is so stupid that if he puts his head in a water trough, sometimes they'll forget to take it out and drown themselves.
That's Ken Christensen. He's 21 and runs his family's turkey farm.
And we have others that we have ventilation fans in our coops, and they will, if you don't keep those fans covered, they will fly up to see what the fan is and fly right into it and kill themselves that way. And quite often when we get storms and things like that that come real suddenly down through the valley, they'll begin to climb on one another, especially if they're just new. They're just young turkeys. They'll get out in the middle of a big field and just begin jumping on top of each other, and all the ones on the bottom will get killed eventually because they just keep jumping. So you have to keep them under a shed. And when they're young, you have to make sure they get under the shed when it starts raining or anything like that, because a lot of times they'll just stay out in the weathering and kill themselves. There are a lot of different ways. Turkeys are suicidal by nature, I believe. It's just the way they are. And they're not terribly smart. But
how do you butcher them?
We are not in charge of the butchering. We just grow the turkeys, and the processing plant, which is owned by the cooperative, comes by, and we load them up in trucks. We herd them onto trucks, and then they take them there and then unload them. There they're given a shock and treatment.
We're probably one of the largest in the world, in the United States, facility-wise, for turkey processing.
That's Linda Clothier. She's the personnel director for the Moroni Feed Company's processing plant.
We can do 28 to 30,000 birds a day.
What's going on inside now?
Okay, this is the hanging area where the trucks come in with the birds live, and they live hang them and kill them. And these men that you see here are live hanging them out of the trucks onto the shackles. These turkeys will come around the shackles, around to the kill area, which is over here, where we have the killers, and they stand there and cut the jugular vein. These are the killers right here. They figure it costs about $20,000 to train a new killer.
Just because of his mistakes.
Yeah, that's the only way to teach him is to put him there and let him, you know, do it.
What is it that they know how to do so well?
Just the way they cut, the angle they cut on and how they hold the neck. Make sure that they get that jugular vein. Birds come in from the blood room. They go into the scalder of hot water, and that loosens up the feathers. Then they go through about five or six picking machines, which literally, they have rubber fingers on them, and it literally beats the feathers off the birds. And the last thing they do in there is they cut off the feet. Then they come into this, the eviscerating department. They're vacuuming the lungs out of the chest cavity. That's pulling the heads off. Okay, this is the rotomatic, and it vacuums the air out of the bag and clips them off with a metal clip. These people are putting the net on and the little weight sticker. You put a handle in it so you can carry it.
Sixty years ago, I probably would have had to kill my own turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. Now I can buy a Moroni Feed Company turkey here at Dan's Food Town in Salt Lake City. They're sealed in plastic and stacked like cannonballs along the meat counter. All I have to do is take one home, stick it in the oven, and wait until the red thermometer pops up. It's so easy. It's really easy. It's so easy.
That story came to us from Scott Carrier. Thanks for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Tyler Gibbons, Franco Luzzi, and Jason Leonard. There is, of course, much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast, which you can find by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Have a lovely Thanksgiving tomorrow, and we'll be back soon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.